preoccupied that I asked him if he was worried about the Vietnam situation, which had not yet been mentioned. "Yes, very," he replied, without elaborating. At one point he turned to Humphrey and said, "God has a funny way of taking care of things. I think it's because I always try to do right." That night after dinner, Johnson and Humphrey and some of the staff who were there at the ranch sat up until 2 a.m. working on campaign plans. We were supposed to leave at 9 the next morning, but our early departure got pushed back, though, when it was decided we would all go to church in Fredericksburg, about 30 miles from the ranch. Even though this was an unannounced stop, there were a number of reporters and cameras. It was such a tiny church that after the Johnsons took communion, they had to leave their seats in the front row and stand outside until everyone else had taken communion, when they returned for the end of the service. As we returned to the ranch, the president was again at the wheel, followed by an increasingly long line of cars, all headed for his old birthplace, which had been fixed up. As we got out, he picked up the intercom and told the Secret Service agents to allow only photographers to follow us. There ensued about an hour and a half of picture-taking, first at the house, then at the old family graveyard, then outside in a field of cattle, and finally at the superintendent's cottage. It was an extraordinary performance, especially Humphrey's remark when he stepped in a cow flop. "Oh, Mr. President, I've just stepped on the Republican platform." Lunch was ordered by telephone to be ready in 25 minutes. 2 hours and several telephone calls later, we finally all sat down, 14 strong, to a Mexican meal of chili and tamales, at which the discussion was about getting around the Dirksen Amendment in order to preserve foreign aid. The plane, which we had planned to board in Austin, was told to come to the ranch to pick us up. Just before we left, I asked for 2 minutes alone with the president. He took me into his bedroom and sat me on a chair while he lay down on the bed. I then talked in terms I had inherited from Phil and in a way I would never have done later, and that embarrasses me now. I told him I had the feeling that he thought my point of view was different from Phil's, but that in general Phil and I had agreed. I said that, much as I admired and loved President Kennedy, Phil personally had got along with him much better than I had. I also said that I admired the legislation he himself had got passed, and was for him, and wanted to make sure he knew it. Although we had a policy at the post against contributing to campaigns, it had been followed loosely. Phil hadn't actually contributed to campaigns, but I had. I guess I forgot I was now in the other seat, because I told the president that my mother and I both wanted to contribute to his campaign. Later, I came to believe that the paper had to be completely neutral, and I decided never to make another contribution to a presidential campaign. In any case, the president said he had appreciated our help in the past and added warmly that we must see more of each other. He didn't mention an endorsement, said that he understood I had to run an independent paper, and gave me a goodbye kiss. Publicly, I maintained my independent stance throughout the campaign, but privately and openly among my friends, I was clearly an LBJ supporter. My support for him actually got me in trouble with Russ Wiggins. Sometime that fall, Russ and I were together with the president. Charles Roberts, in his history of the Washington Post, reported that I told the president that the Post would not endorse him. According to Charles, when tears welled up in LBJ's eyes, she added, "Oh, we're for you, 100%. Wiggins was appalled at her remark. He knew his boss still had a lot to learn. That was partly true. Though I had made it clear to LBJ from the beginning that we wouldn't endorse him, I felt he could read between the lines of the paper and realize that the Post was positive about his programs. Yet Russ was right to be upset that I had said we were for him. Despite what he had said to me, our sticking to our policy of non-endorsement actually hurt LBJ deeply. He couldn't understand how he could have won over so many Republican, even right-wing papers, and yet not have received the endorsement of the liberal Washington Post. I'm also sure that he assumed that Phil's old paper and his hometown paper, the paper to which he had been so generous, would endorse him. He must have felt that, after all the kindnesses he had shown me, all the extra special attention, I would surely come round and bring the paper with me. But I not only had inherited this policy of non-endorsement for the paper, I believed in it. Of course, Phil had broken the policy in 1952 for Eisenhower, but that was only for the Republican nomination, not the election itself. I could have changed the policy to endorse LBJ, but Russ didn't want to, and I didn't do much independent thinking yet, nor would I have liked to differ with Russ over such a big issue so early in our working relationship. The fall campaign was in full swing when Scotty Reston suggested that I go along on the press plane of each candidate for a couple of days to experience for myself what a campaign is really like. I decided to do just that, so Charles Roberts and I joined the president's press contingent in Indianapolis. There we met up with Chuck Roberts of Newsweek, and the three of us drove to the center of town, where the president was about to speak from a platform next to the Soldier and Sailor Monument. LBJ was on the highest level, and we were on a level below with several other press people. I was walking around enjoying the drama of the scene when I felt a tap on my shoulder and turned to see Agent Rufus Youngblood. I was wearing a shocking pink wool coat, so the president had spotted me. "Mrs. Graham, the president wants to see you," he said.
"Wants to see me where?" I asked.
"Up there,"
he said, pointing to the higher platform.
"I can't go up there," I exclaimed.
LBJ was standing almost alone on the small platform several yards above us. Gently, Rufus said,
"Mrs. Graham, you have to."
I climbed some steps up a ladder and stopped when my head was on a level with his platform and said hello.
"Do you want a ride with me?" the president asked.
This was not too long after the weekend at the ranch, and for the paper's sake I didn't want to seem too close to him, so I cautiously replied, "No, Mr. President, I really can't thank you enough for the offer, but I'm out here to ride with the press."
Typically, he teased, "You got a boyfriend on the plane?"
I said alas no, but I wanted to get the feel of the campaign and of the reporters as they covered it.
"Well," he replied, "come and see me at the hotel in Cleveland."
I carefully climbed back down the ladder and rejoined Charles and Chuck, and we were shortly off to Cleveland. The press plane was great fun, as were the buses that followed the president's motorcade. No doubt the whole thing can quickly get tiresome if you have to follow an entire campaign, dragging yourself from one campaign stop to another. But for me, limited as the experience was, it was constantly stimulating. It was certainly very different from what happens on today's press planes, where reporters have much less access to the candidate and his managers. When we arrived in Cleveland, I went up to LBJ's room. The president was lying on one of the beds in his suite, and Jack Valenti was there as well. They were talking about how Lady Bird's train trip campaign swing through the southern states was going. Something displeased the president while I was in the room, and I became an awkward witness to a scene I wouldn't soon forget. He suddenly turned on Jack and laid him out savagely, the unpleasantness exacerbated by being delivered in front of a relative stranger. It was quite callous and inhuman, something I have never witnessed before or since. I had heard about LBJ's temper, but had never seen it in action. Jack, however, was used to these tantrums and remained unflustered while I squirmed. I escaped as quickly as possible. We went on to Louisville and continued the next day to Nashville, ending as planned in New Orleans, where the president's campaign group was to meet up with Lady Bird and her entourage, who had completed their southern swing by train. In order to stay true to my goal of some balance, I also rode along on the Goldwater press plane, flying first to New York and then on to Los Angeles for the night, from where we left for a whistle-stop tour to San Diego. Much as I disagreed with his views, Goldwater himself was a charming man, and it was fun to watch him speak to the crowds gathered for his quick campaign stops. A month following the first anniversary of Phil's death, Lally came to me in great excitement with her young beau, Jan Weymouth, to tell me they were engaged and wanted to be married in a few months. Jan was in architecture school at MIT, and Lally would be entering her senior year at Radcliffe. I felt that they were both awfully young, but I kept my concerns to myself, deciding that articulating them would do no good and might harm my relationship with Lally and Jan. I even wrote my mother, trying to be reassuring about the marriage to a greater extent than I felt. A part of that letter expressed both my anxiety and some of my attitudes about women in those days.
One of my worries about Lally was that she so adored her father she might not be able to find someone who measured up to him in her eyes. The good thing about Jan is that she not only loves him, she looks up to him in every way, mentally and morally. He leads and she follows, given the strength and will of our girl. This had to be a rare and lucky thing for her to find. I spent much of November, after the president's overwhelming election, dealing with company business, while at the same time immersing myself in plans for a Thanksgiving weekend wedding. One interlude was an evening at the White House that didn't seem so funny at the time as it does today. Joe and Susan Mary and I were invited to a small party for the Johnsons' 30th wedding anniversary. We were the only three semi-outsiders at what was essentially a party of close friends and associates. The Valentis, Liz Carpenter and her husband, the Abe Fortises, and only a few others were there. The president was in, or perhaps developed over the course of the evening, a very bad mood. There was a coffee table smothered in lovely done-up presents, Susan Mary recalled. He looked at it and said, "What's all this trash? Get rid of it, Bird, and let's have something to eat." We had dinner in the beautiful oval family dining room upstairs, with the French wallpaper paid for by the Dillons under Jackie's restoration project. Joe, unfortunately, banged on a bit about Vietnam, which didn't help the president's mood. After dinner, which hadn't lasted long, we returned to the family living room, but LBJ left early for his bedroom, which was adjacent to the living room, while the rest of us sat around talking. We were in the process of saying goodnight to Lady Bird when the double doors of the bedroom were flung open and the president looked at me in obvious anger and barked, "Come here!" I glanced hopefully over my shoulder to see if he could possibly be referring to anyone else, but it was clearly me he wanted. "And you come here, too," he called to Abe Fortas. We went into his bedroom, where on the turned-down bed lay the early edition of the Post, with a large headline saying that Walter Tobriner, the lead commissioner for the District of Columbia, in effect the appointed mayor, had named a new police chief. LBJ was livid. He said he had told Tobriner not to do anything without discussing it with him, because he had wanted to appoint a super police chief to address the problem of crime in Washington, the only place a president can get his hands on the issue, since elsewhere it's up to the states. President Johnson equated me with the Post and viewed the article's appearance in the next morning's paper as entirely my fault. The Post had endorsed Tobriner, and "this stupid son of a bitch," as LBJ referred to him, had gone ahead and deprived him of appointing the kind of person he wanted. He was ranting at me, "Tobriner was your creation," etc., etc. As he was yelling at me, he started to undress, flinging his clothes off onto a chair and the floor, his coat, his tie, his shirt. Finally, he was down to his pants. I was frozen with dismay and baffled about what to do. I remember thinking to myself, "This can't be me being bawled out by the President of the United States while he's undressing." Suddenly, he bellowed, "Turn around!" I did so, obediently and gratefully, and he went right on with his angry monologue until I turned back at his command to find him in his pajamas. He bid the two of us a curt good night, and Abe and I turned on our heels and vanished. The last big event of the year for me was Lally and Jan's wedding, held in the Navy Chapel in Washington, with the reception at home. Felix Frankfurter had written Lally, saying that he felt Phil would have wanted him to give her away, but by that time he was in a wheelchair from a stroke. And so it was Don who walked her down the aisle. She wore a beautiful Mamboche dress given to her by her grandmother. Although the marriage lasted only a few years, out of it came two marvelous children, Catherine and Pamela Weymouth, my oldest granddaughters. Chapter 19. For people who lose a spouse, the year that immediately follows is horribly painful, and so it was for me. After the first year, however, comes a more bearable kind of grief that allows accommodation to the outside world, the world that just carries on no matter what has happened to you. The difficulties of my job remained enormous. I still had little idea of how to relate to people in a business environment, and no idea how closely I was being watched by everyone. Within the company,
Whatever I said or did, even my body language, sent a stronger message to people than I realized. In addition, I had spent a lifetime with dramatically impressive people and probably dismissed as unimportant too many quiet, unassuming, but hard-working people throughout the company. It took me a while to learn that certain people may have important skills that are not always blazingly apparent. Gradually, I came to realize, slow as I may have been, that what mattered was performance, that sometimes people might have to be helped to develop, and that it takes all kinds to make an organization run properly. I made mistakes and suffered great distress from them, partly because I believed that if you just worked diligently enough, you wouldn't make mistakes. I truly believed that other people in my position didn't make mistakes. I couldn't see that everybody makes them, even people with great experience. What I did that I'm certain my male counterparts did not, and which was particularly tormenting, was to lie awake at night, reliving events of the day, going over and over certain scenes, wondering how I could have managed whatever it was differently. Yet despite all my insecurities and misgivings, I was gradually beginning to enjoy myself. And unconsciously, somewhere along the line, I seemed to have begun redefining my job and what it was I was doing. Indeed, within the first months of my new working life, the color started returning to my face, my jaw was beginning to unclench, and what I had once called my initial Girl Scout type of resolve was turning into a passionate interest. In short, as I said in a speech at Newsweek, I sort of fell in love. I loved my job, I loved the paper, I loved the whole company. As I wrote Frank Waldrop, I suppose it's odd to speak of loving the company, but all I'm doing is agreeing with Colonel McCormick when he said a newspaper is a living thing. Gradually, too, I began to learn. The Montessori method, learning by doing, once again became my stock in trade. One of my greatest learning tools over the years was the trips I took with various editors and reporters from The Post and Newsweek. These trips, which, more than 30 years later, now number nearly as many as the years that have passed, were among the richest and most rewarding of all the many opportunities available to me as head of a communications company. Of course, I had been to Europe several times with Phil, but my first trip as the executive rather than as the spouse who often got left out of the most interesting occasions was something altogether unusual. It was an around-the-world venture with Oz Elliott and his then-wife Deirdre, or Dee, and I loved it. The only drawback was having to leave Bill and Steve again, this time for 6 weeks, far too long. I may have been the president, but I was still a woman, and I recall being upset when I received a letter from Newsweek's correspondent in Hong Kong, Bob McCabe, asking if I really wanted to be included in stag lunches and substantive briefings during the trip. "Naturally I want to go," I replied somewhat indignantly. "Since I have been working, I never seem to notice whether I am with men or women. As I happen to be on this job, I obviously want to learn as much as I can." Some matters specific to women couldn't be avoided, however, as evidenced by the expression of horror on Oz Elliott's face when I met him in San Francisco at the end of January 1965. I was carrying a large, not inconspicuous, yellow and red box with the name Kenneth on it for the well-known hairdresser in New York. It was the fashion in the mid-1960s to use fake hair or falls over the back of your head, with your own hair combed over the front, which both puffed out your hair and eliminated the need to have it done when you were traveling. My box contained my fall, or wig, pinned to a felt head shape inside. On seeing me, Oz announced firmly, "Don't think I'm ever going to carry that for you." I laughed, realizing how ridiculous it looked, and said, "Don't worry, I'll carry it myself." That settled, we took off. Our first stop in Japan included a visit to Asahi, then the largest newspaper in Japan, with a circulation of many millions. Next was one to a large advertising agency, Dentsu, where I was stunned to find a big sign reading, "Welcome, Mrs. Philip L. Graham," and about 80 people, mostly young women, who applauded as I stepped inside. A startling Japanese display of manners. We had a brief meeting with Prime Minister Sato, and within the next few days we also met separately with Kiichi Miyazawa and with Yasuhiro Nakasone, both of whom later became prime minister. I am abashed to admit that what I remember of Nakasone from that meeting is that he made the list of sexy men which D. Eliot and I were compiling as we circled the globe. On February 1st, we had an audience with the Emperor and Empress. This formal interview with the sovereign, we were told, was the first he had granted to a woman in her own right. Despite the pomp and high drama associated with the occasion, the whole visit had a musical comedy aspect to it. Before we were escorted into the meeting place, we were briefed by a striped pants equerry, whom we asked whether we should shake hands with the Emperor, bow, or what.
"His Majesty would be very pleased to shake your hand," the attendant replied in a tone, Oz recalled, that suggested we should treat the Emperor as we would any regular god.
Once briefed, we trooped into a hideous audience room, laden with overstuffed furniture, with antimacassars on the plush brocade coverings. The Emperor and Empress appeared, and we all sat down stiffly, with the Emperor and me on a kind of love seat across from Oz, interpreters close by for all of us. There was a long silence while we waited, as instructed, for the royals to begin the conversation. The Emperor had a way of wringing his hands and sort of bouncing up and down, so much so that Oz, who was sitting across the room, recalled that every time he went up in the love seat, Kay went down. What the Emperor began with was the question, which was duly translated, "Is this your first trip to Japan, Mrs. Graham?" I heard myself saying, "Yes, it's my first trip, and Mrs. Elliot's as well, but Oz was here during the war, many years ago." I could almost feel Oz trying not to laugh. None of the conversation was gripping or important. Rather, it was stilted and artificial, painful even. After one long stretch of silence, I actually volunteered, "Well, Your Majesty, we understand you're interested in marine biology," and then told him about Oz's being on the board of the Natural History Museum in New York. That topic, too, went nowhere. We had worried about how we would know when the interview was over, but quite abruptly, the Emperor turned to his wife. They arose as one. We all shook hands again, with, as Oz said later, the Emperor appearing to be so unused to shaking hands that he watched his hand go up and down to make sure he got it back. And it was over. The retainer in striped pants assured us the meeting was a great success. Everywhere we went throughout Asia, Vietnam was the principal subject of discussion. After a stop in Hong Kong, we flew on to Saigon for a closer look at the country that would get so much of our attention over the next decade. We landed at an airfield that seemed equally divided between civilian traffic and military helicopters and fighters, a fantastic jumble of peace and war. Saigon at the time was ringed by the Viet Cong, with very few safe roads leading into and out of the city. The Viet Cong came right onto the airfield at times, and just a few weeks before our arrival, a bomb had gone off on the fifth floor of the Caravelle Hotel, where many from the American press stayed, and where we too were staying. I took some comfort in being on the fourth floor. This visit, in early February 1965, was in the days when the number of American advisers was mounting, but still relatively small. We were not yet directly involved, but Newsweek had two or three correspondents there, and the Post had one. After a briefing by Army officers the day following our arrival, we lunched with General and Mrs. Westmoreland. Throughout this trip, I used letters home as a way of setting down my observations and experiences. Of Westmoreland, I wrote, "He is an inarticulate soldier type of a peculiar kind. If he is bright, it is as a technician, because he certainly doesn't communicate, is tense and uneasy and almost scared." Oz and I, Bob McCabe and Bill Toohey of Newsweek, all left right after lunch in a small helicopter for a visit to a nearby, about 25 miles away, base not far from the Cambodian border, on the top of Black Lady Mountain, on the outer edge of a patch of land completely dominated by the Viet Cong, but used by the Americans for radio communications with planes in the area. When we got in the helicopter, a Bell UH-1B called a Huey, I was startled to find that we were to sit on a bench situated horizontally in the small cab of the helicopter, which had its sides off so that your feet were on the edge of the cab. I was right behind the pilot, and tried to look cool, as though this sort of thing was routine for me. When we took off, leaving the sides or doors of the helicopter behind, I held my breath. I was even more startled at seeing soldiers toward the rear of each side, holding loaded machine guns. We flew low, at about 2,500 feet, over rice paddies and fields. The single houses below us, according to the major from the Army's Public Relations Department who accompanied us, belonged to Viet Cong's sympathizers. Government people lived in armed hamlets surrounded by trenches and barbed wire. None too soon, we landed on a tiny helicopter pad, big enough for only 2 helicopters. The mountain was held by special forces, our advisors, mostly Marines. We were met by a Steve Canyon-type figure, Lieutenant Sodlin, who felt even then that the relationship between the Americans and the South Vietnamese was frustrating, and that it would take at least 5 years to judge the results. On this mountaintop, there were 13 Americans and about 100 South Vietnamese soldiers. The entire area was laced with barbed wire and machine gun emplacements. Our guide claimed that they were quite safe there, though subject to harassments, and that the area was actually surprisingly peaceful. Around Thanksgiving, just a few months before, CBS had done a broadcast from the mountaintop, bringing in roast turkey for the soldiers. A live turkey had been dropped in earlier and had been granted a reprieve from the feast, becoming a pet of sorts. The Vietnamese had hung a red special services scarf around his neck, and now he wandered around as if the entire zone were his fiefdom. As we got ready to leave, one of the resident soldiers explained that when we took off from the mountaintop, the helicopter would drop sharply before rising. I was grateful for the warning, which was not enough to calm my nerves, but helped me understand my stomach dropping as I watched the gunners crouch over their weapons until we had left the ground safely behind us. Only my extreme interest in seeing more of South Vietnam prevented me, who under normal circumstances even disliked elevators, from panicking during those helicopter rides, but I got back in to visit 2 villages in the Mekong Delta where pacification was said to have worked. We also went to the provincial capital of Ben Tre in Kien Hoa province, and then drove on to a nearby hamlet, Binh Nguyen, where we met with an optimistic and determined province chief, Colonel Chow, who talked about how he was building strength in the hamlet. The Viet Cong had been creating infrastructure and developing people for 20 years, we were told, but the American advisors and the South Vietnamese military leaders still felt they were making progress. Only one American colonel cautioned that the Viet Cong seemed to be everywhere and to be willing to pay any price for their inroads. I was unsure how to react to the things we saw, heard, and did. Certainly our trip was circumscribed by the public relations officers who took us around. More important, my feeling that I knew very little about the history of the conflict and the issues involved meant that I kept to my normal approach of listening a lot and questioning little. I also tended to accept Russ Wiggins's views on the main issues with which the Post wrestled, and I knew how strongly he favored American involvement in Vietnam. My habit of listening to what the men in my life said resulted in my leaving Vietnam with much the same views I had when I arrived, i.e., maybe we shouldn't have been there in the first place, even in small numbers, but we were there, and there was no choice but to help the South Vietnamese in their fight against the communist guerrillas. As Charles Roberts later wrote of Wiggins, he was not a mindless hawk. He was repelled by the all-out war proponents. Indeed, Russ was never mindless about anything. He thought long and hard about the positions he took. The Post gained a reputation for strong support of American involvement in the war, and Russ supported Lyndon Johnson on the war throughout his presidency, not because he blindly went along with whatever LBJ put forth, but because he believed that the United States had to use its power to prevent the usurpation of legitimate authority from taking place around the world. But there was a great deal that bothered Russ about the predicament of Vietnam. He felt strongly that our advanced knowledge of the 1963 assassination of Diem, the head of a state with which we were allied, created grave problems and the spectacle of being a rotten and faithless ally. In fact, he was always looking for an alternative to American involvement in Vietnam that wouldn't destroy the international position of the United States government. My own position on Vietnam continued to parallel Russ's, changing only very gradually as time passed, until I had a son serving there, which gave me my own private view and inside perspective on the war, and until Phil Jalin arrived to take over the editorial page, and we gradually began to turn the editorial position of the paper around. We left Vietnam on February 10th, and after brief stopovers in Cambodia and Thailand, moved on to India for a dizzying few days. One of our most astonishing interviews there was with the white-coated population minister, or at least the coat had at one time been white and was now a dirty gray. He sat in a dusty office at his cluttered desk, on which were arrayed a variety of population control devices, and he kept picking up an IUD inserter and playing with it, swinging it and knocking it against his palm. I will never forget his saying, "Many of the ladies, when they use the IUD, they complain of headaches, but I do not think the headaches come from the IUD. Rather, I think the headaches come from the in-laws." An all-night flight from New Delhi took us over burning oil fields that lit up the desert, to Beirut, still untouched and beautiful. The Lebanese never ceased arguing about Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian strongman, during our entire visit. From Lebanon we went on to Egypt, where we interviewed Nasser himself, from which meeting an ugly misunderstanding ensued. Nasser had a reputation in the Middle East for playing the East against the West, with Egypt benefiting from Cold War conflicts. East German President Walter Ulbricht had visited Cairo just the month before, and during our interview we asked Nasser if he had been pressured by the Soviet Union to invite Ulbricht. Nasser said no, although probably it was true. Unfortunately, the issue of Newsweek that appeared a few days after our interview reported just the opposite. That piece actually had no connection with our interview and had not been seen by me or by any of our Newsweek staff in Beirut at the time of the interview. We had tried to wire ahead a few lines from our interview, but they had not arrived in time to be included. The interview was reported accurately in the Post a few days later, but by then Nasser had flown into a rage, calling us liars seeking only to discredit us. No amount of explaining helped. Eventually, I learned to accept most such unintentional mistakes and confusions with some grace, and not to take them personally. We flew home via Rome and London, where we mostly rested and partied. In Rome, I had a passing flirtation with an attractive Italian journalist. Afterwards, Pam Berry encouraged my little fling in Rome by writing me, "Do be female and free and frivolous from time to time. It will be terribly good for you in every sort of way. I'd been worried that you would gradually immolate yourself in work, but when you walked into Cowley Street last Thursday, I saw a huge difference, though without knowing why." I worked as hard on this trip as I'd ever worked, but far from being tiring, the whole experience was strengthening, and I returned with more energy and enthusiasm for my job than ever. One trip I took that summer was just for fun, and it was that. Truman Capote had told me that he was going cruising with Mirella Agnelli, the international beauty and wife of Gianni Agnelli, the head of Fiat. Mirella had chartered a large sailboat for a tour of the Adriatic and through the Greek Isles, and was inviting Truman and a group of her friends or relations, whom I knew to be in the international jet set. I had come a fair distance in worldliness, but not that far, so I told Truman that I wouldn't fit in and would feel ill at ease, but eventually I accepted Morella's invitation, though with great reservations. This trip was different from anything I'd experienced before, and a reflection of my new life. It wasn't something Phil would ever have done, nor would I have done it without him, and the Puritan in me worried about it even then. Truman and I decided to get to our rendezvous with Mirella via London in order to visit the Bruces and Pam Berry on the way. Adlai Stevenson had earlier suggested that he and I stay with his sister, Buffy Ives, at her house in Switzerland that summer, and I had been relieved to be able to tell him that I couldn't because of the Mirella trip. On our arrival in London, my heart sank a little to find that Adlai was there too, also staying with the Bruces at the U.S. Embassy in Grosvenor Square. However, the guests were so numerous that week that things were easy and agreeable. Adlai's great friend Marietta Tree was also in London. On our third night, July 13th, we all went off in different directions, he to do a BBC broadcast. When I came in from dinner, I noticed him talking to someone in the upstairs study. Since it was late, and I couldn't see whom Adlai was talking with and didn't want to interrupt, I tiptoed past the room and went to my bedroom at the end of the hall. I was still reading when the door flew open and in breezed Adlai, full of reproaches about my not having joined him and Eric Severide, with whom he'd been talking while waiting for me to return. Adlai stayed in my room for at least an hour. When he departed, he left behind his tie and his glasses, so I crept quietly down the hall to his bedroom and put them in front of his door. The next day, when I got back to the embassy in the late afternoon, the butler answered the bell, looking very glum, and immediately asked me, "Have you heard about Governor Stevenson?"
"No," I responded. "What is it?"
"He's dead," was the reply. I was crushed and disbelieving. He had been walking with Marietta in the rare late afternoon British sunshine when he just fell to the ground with a fatal heart attack. Eric Severide arrived as I stood there, as did Marietta and Phil Kaiser, minister at the embassy, who were returning from the hospital. They had gone there in the ambulance with Adlai. Eric told me that he thought Adlai had looked unusually tired. Several times during their conversation the night before, Adlai had leaned back and closed his eyes. Not exactly how I had found him later, I ruminated, thinking guiltily of the glasses and tie at his door. Adlai had spoken to me, as he did to many of us, about wanting to resign from his position at the United Nations, to take a rest, and then go back into private business. But I had no idea how tired he must have been. In many ways, he was an unhappy man. Eric Severide said on the CBS Evening News a few days later that Adlai had told him, "For a while I would just like to sit in the shade with a glass of wine in my hands and watch people dance." Morella's father had also died while we were in London, and she had to be in Italy a week longer than expected, so our plans changed, and Truman and I flew to Athens and departed in lonely splendor on Morella's beautiful boat, the Silvia, stocked with a great deal of my favorite Italian wine. Truman had with him the galleys of In Cold Blood in the four sections that were to appear first in the New Yorker. Sitting for hours on the back deck of the boat in the balmy air, we discussed it all in detail, section by section. Why he had done what he'd done, what the murderers were like, what Garden City, Kansas was like, the characters of the detective and the judge, his own life while in Kansas. We finally met up with Morella and the other guests and set off on a route based partly on a book by Freya Stark, Lycian Shores. Our goal was to go down the southern coast of Turkey, at that time almost undeveloped. The boat wasn't big enough for all of us, and on top of that was unair-conditioned, which made life somewhat difficult in the extreme heat that set in. But Morella herself was casual and generous and uncomplaining, and the entire voyage was a happy interlude of R&R in an otherwise turbulent year. When I had first gone to work at the post, I assumed that things would carry on as they always had. One area that surprisingly started to shift under my feet was the post's editorial quality. I hadn't realized that the post wasn't perfectly okay as it was. I had great faith in Al Friendly as managing editor and in Russ Wiggins as editor, leading the editorial page, and basically believed that all was well. In fact, almost a year to the day after Phil's death, I wrote Al a personal letter saying, "You must know without this word, but I want to say it anyway, that you've done so well for this year and been so great." One of the first people to put into my head the idea that the paper wasn't all that it should or could be was Scotty Reston, who on a visit to Glen Welby asked, "Don't you want to leave a better paper for the next generation than the one you inherited?" This may not seem like a startling question, but it was to me. I had not considered that we weren't making the kind of progress that we had in the past, or that what we were doing wasn't good enough for the 1960s. It's difficult to recall how I eventually became seriously concerned about what was happening on the editorial floor, on the news side, but there were many signals, and I certainly was beginning to think about the direction the paper should be taking. The two people I talked privately to about the future were Walter Lippmann and Scotty. In truth, I felt I needed Scotty, who was such a close personal friend, to help me move the paper forward, and in the summer of 1964, I met with him several times to discuss the possibility of his coming to the post. One of the things we talked about was his concern over Phil's overstepping his bounds as publisher and we agreed that working with me would be different. Finally, with Fritz's help, and after consultation with Walter and Russ Wiggins, I offered him the rather ill-defined job of advising the paper editorially while continuing his column. This was completely impractical, but I was unwilling to disturb Russ and Al, to whom I remained devoted and grateful. Scotty quite rightly rejected this offer, firmly but kindly, and very constructively. We carried on without him, but gradually I had to acknowledge that there was a problem. How could I tell? I certainly didn't have a sophisticated judgment about the quality of our news product, but I was observing a great deal of indecision among the executives, followed by some odd decisions, especially about people. I sensed a certain lack of adrenaline, and through the grapevine I heard talk of stagnation in the city room. One report that reached me said that you could swing a dead cat around the city room after 9 at night and not hit anyone. Then there was Al himself. Bob Manning, who was working for the government, came to see me with the idea that he replace Al Friendly, that he was what was needed to revitalize the paper. I rejected the suggestion out of hand, but that episode, too, left a seed of doubt. By 1965, Al had been managing editor for 10 years, and people were commenting on how he was aging. He did seem to be getting tired, and he was clearly growing hard of hearing, which made difficulties for him on the job. He himself must have felt some concern, since he decided he should take 2 months' vacation every year. He and Jean had bought a place in Turkey and wanted to spend time there. Al was my friend, but the managing editor is a key figure who gets the paper out each day, and the idea of 2 months off worried me. All these were clear warning signals, but I was puzzled about what to do about them. Not only had Al done a fine job with meager resources over many years, but he and Jean were such close personal friends that it was unthinkable to upset him. When I tried to suggest to him that the paper could use some energizing, he seemed to dismiss my feelings and obviously didn't take my judgment seriously. So I conceived the idea of asking him to talk with others, particularly Walter Lippmann, to find out what they thought of the paper and what he might do to move it forward. He agreed, but by then Walter had gone to Maine, and they couldn't get together at that time. In the meantime, I had learned that Ben Bradley had twice been offered promotions by Newsweek, which would have entailed his moving to New York, but had turned them down. Although I had gone back and forth to New York with him on various trips for Newsweek, and had had a few meetings and lunches with him, I didn't know Ben very well. I still associated him with Phil's bad period, when I thought he had taken sides. But I knew that he ran a good bureau, had good people working for him, and was generally well regarded. And I realized that he was eminently hireable and worried about losing him from the company, especially to some television network, which I feared might recruit him, since he was good-looking and appealing. Because I wanted to discover what his ambitions were, I invited him to lunch. I had never done such a thing before. In those days it was still a little awkward, I felt, for a woman to take a man to lunch and to pay the check. So in December 1964 I took him to the F Street Club, where I could sign for the bill, those were the pre-credit card days, and avoid a scene about who would pay, so odd to think of now. Our talk meandered around. I asked him why he hadn't gone to Newsweek in New York, although I knew that he and his wife Tony had 6 children living with them, 4 of hers and 2 of theirs, apart from Ben Jr., Ben's son from an earlier marriage, which would make changing cities difficult. He told me he liked running the bureau here in Washington and was in no hurry to move on. "But what would you like to do in the long run?" I asked. "Well, since you asked," Ben responded with his typical picturesque language, "I'd give my left one to be managing editor of the Post." I was stunned. This was neither the question he expected nor the answer I anticipated or even welcomed. However, given the context of my concerns, it was certainly a thinkable thought. What I said to Ben was that we could discuss the idea, but not right now, or at any time soon. Ben, however, saw his opening and pursued it, hard. I'd see him around, and he'd say, "When are we going to talk some more? What are we going to do next?" I was surprised by his tenacity. I used the time to check out the idea with Scotty, who didn't know Ben personally, but thought it might work out. Walter Lippmann, who did know Ben, reacted favorably, saying he thought Ben could do great things for the paper. Encouraged by that, I took the idea to Fritz, who heartily approved, and to Oz, who of course did too. Ben and I met several more times in the course of the next few months. He made it clear that he didn't want to give up a job he loved in order to sit around the post waiting for Al to retire in 2 or 3 years. He was, however, willing to come to the paper and wait 1 year. I didn't like that prospect. Part of me thought, what gall this guy has to be so pushy when he doesn't even have the job. But part of me thought, maybe this is exactly what we need and what I'm looking for. Ben kept pushing, and I kept delaying, until the early summer of 1965, when I finally brought up with Russ and Al the idea of bringing Ben over from Newsweek as assistant managing editor. They both reacted negatively at first. Russ said he should come in as a reporter like anyone else and work his way up. Al was on the ladder to be head of the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 2 or 3 years, and he very much wanted to do that, so he wasn't in a great hurry to give up being managing editor and lose the opportunity. Ben actually told Al that he wanted to move up within a year, to which Al responded, "What's your hurry, Buster?" Ben finally came to the post, agreeing to disagree. On July 7, 1965, it was announced by Russ and Al that Ben would join the Post as deputy managing editor with principal responsibilities in the area of national and foreign news coverage. He was young, 43, and had been Newsweek's Washington bureau chief for 4 years. Mel Elfin was appointed the new bureau chief and served that office reliably and well for the next 20 years. At the Post, Ben Gilbert, one of the last of the first-rate old-timers, was made deputy managing editor for local news and administration. Ben was to take up his new duties on September 1st, but he arrived on August 2nd, having taken no vacation. He left Newsweek on a Saturday and came to the Post on the following Monday. I had written him on July 20th, saying I had had a nice note from Al telling me that Ben had learned more in spare half-hours than had others in months. Indeed, Ben hit the ground running. Then and always, Ben was charismatic. He was good-looking in an unconventional way, funny, street-smart, and political, all of which stood him in good stead. What was also always important was how hard he worked. In his determination to learn, he worked into the night and on Saturdays, too, and what he quickly observed was that Russ was concentrating on the editorial page and that Al had indeed lost his energy. By default, Ben Gilbert, by controlling all the screws and the screwdrivers, really ran the paper. Ben saw Al as not knowing the basics of the paper, the various production departments and the unions, for example, and felt that his lack of knowledge had been to the detriment of the Post. From the beginning, Ben saw that, to be a good editor, it was important to know how things came together. What I hoped was that the issue of timing would slide. I couldn't see my way around the problem of moving Al out and wished the whole matter would quietly go away. But few things regarding Ben are ever quiet. That fall, after Al and Jean's vacation in Turkey, Al and I resumed our talks about the future of the paper. He told me that he had made a lunch date with Walter Lippmann, as I had suggested. Walter called me, too, and asked, "How far do you want me to go?" I said as far as he felt he could at the time, suggesting he just feel your way. By this I meant, and thought Walter meant, talking to Al about the inadequacies of the paper and what we should do to improve it. I had nothing else in mind. The phone rang after the lunch, and it was Walter, who said, "Well, the conversation went so well, I went all the way." Having not heard that expression since high school, I anxiously asked, "What do you mean by all the way, Walter?" "Well," he replied, "I told him that these administrative jobs wore people out, and there came a time when they should think about giving it up and going back to writing." I was dumbstruck. I had no idea Walter was going to go to that point with Al. Ben had only been at the paper for 3 months, and I had no intention of dislodging Al that early. I thought that even Ben, who was pushing, was still assuming it would take a full year, while I was assuming even longer. Unbeknownst to me, Ben must have been pushing from other directions, too, and talking about the situation with Al directly. His impatience is reflected in a letter Henry Brandon, correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, wrote to his editor, Dennis Hamilton, on October 12th.
Ben B. told me that the situation with Al still in the chair and him assigned to kill the sacred cows cannot endure, that he will press for a decision within the next 2 months.
Press he may have done, but I couldn't have faced my old and dear friend and asked him to step aside that abruptly. However, because Walter had indeed gone all the way, and because I really knew by then that it was best for all concerned, I went ahead with the change. So much for my alleged courage. I had barely hung up from talking to Walter when Al came into my office, looking stricken and pale, and said, "Is this what you want?" There was no going back. The awful deed had been done for me, so I just said, "Yes, I'm afraid it is." Al, with justice totally on his side, sadly said, "I wish I'd heard it from you." I can't remember whether I tried to explain, but I do remember the pain we both felt. Even Ben was surprised at how fast everything happened in the end. On November 15th, it was announced that he would become managing editor of the Washington Post, succeeding Al. There was something in the announcement to the effect that Al had asked to be relieved of executive duties and to resume an earlier career of reporting and writing on national and international affairs. Al became associate editor of the paper, continuing as vice president and a member of the company's board of directors. The strain with Al and Jean was grim, but they both did their best to be polite, even coming to Glen Welby for a weekend. The miracle was that eventually Al rebuilt his life as a stellar reporter. Luckily, he owned a lot of stock in the newspaper and was wealthy, so he was able to buy a flat in London, as well as maintain the house in Turkey and his large home in Georgetown. Most important, things becoming too uncomfortable here at home, he eventually went abroad to write and report. There he did some of his best journalistic work, and won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Six-Day War in the Middle East. Eventually our friendship resumed, and for that great credit went to Al and Jean, who might well have harbored a grudge forever, but were too large-minded for that. Later, Al wrote me that he had only two regrets about the shift. One was that I hadn't the wit to have initiated it myself, and the second is that I was awkward in failing to find myself afterwards. I think that's a measure of extraordinary character in a man who had essentially been fired. Ironically, on November 2nd, just before the announcement of Ben's taking over, Al had sent me a "Whither the Washington Post" memo that began, "By good luck and good management, all the conditions are present to make the Post the best paper in the world." He had ended this 7-page memo with what he called a final word. "To move from where we are to becoming the best will require some very tough decisions, the toughest of which, having to do with intentions and goals and attitudes about spending, must of course be made by you. They will not be easy or serene or reachable overnight." He was right on all counts. Chapter 20. Ben set to work at once to build up the paper. He and his cronies at Newsweek had been critical of what they saw as uninspired writing and unassertive managing at the Post. He was determined to be different. A great discoverer and developer of talent, he hired some big, well-known bylines, quickly bringing in Stanley Carno and Joe Kraft, Ward Just, and Dick Harwood. Bart Rowan came over from Newsweek as financial editor and started to expand what had been a business staff of one. A signal arrival was the star political reporter David Broder, who came from the New York Times. Ben also hired Nicholas von Hoffman, who was the first to cover the drug scene at Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, writing about it so graphically that Ben was inspired to fly to San Francisco to observe this hippie world for himself. Nick, with his eccentricity and originality, required an editor willing to take risks, which Ben was. The Post also benefited from the demise of at least 3 New York papers after severe labor problems caused a crisis. From the Herald Tribune came Harry Rosenfeld, who became Knight foreign editor, and later Dave Laventhal, both strong additions to our editing staff. From 1966 to 1969, we added about 50 news positions. Our editorial budget rose by $2.25 million to over $7 million in 1969. There were departures, too, during these years, some of which signaled a real changing of the guard. When the longtime Night City editor, John Risling, the head photographer, Hugh Miller, and Eddie Folliard, a brilliant reporter on politics and national affairs, each decided to retire at about the same time, I gave a goodbye party celebrating the 130 years they had together served the post. Other departures later on worried me a great deal. I was deeply distressed over losing good people and was sure they had left because of something I'd done or neglected to do, not realizing they may have had other opportunities too good to decline. Probably Ben was less capable as a manager than as a finder of talent, but he somehow managed by osmosis. The important thing was that he excited people under him, eventually corrected whatever mistakes he made, and moved on. He rapidly learned the ropes, including how to deal with John Sweeterman about budgets. Because John knew more than Ben did about his own budget, Ben met total defeat the first year. It never happened again. When he went in the next year and dealt with John on more even terms and with my unspoken backing, things began to change. John respected people who knew what they were talking about and who wanted what was best for the paper. Ben was driving to make the paper better, and of course, that kind of push was expensive. Ben's arrival changed my life in an unexpected way. He was the first person placed in a major position by me, and the difference between my relationship with him and my relationship with most of the people who had been at the post before me was striking. Despite my controlling ownership, to those who were already there, I was still the newcomer, the junior partner. Even though they were mostly friendly and generous, they were almost always the leaders and teachers, and I was the follower. Ben and I, however, were partners, very much together in focusing on our common goals. Though some may have viewed him as a bizarre choice, it was the right one for me. Ideas flew out of Ben. He was always asking important why questions. Why not build, start, or buy a printing plant in suburban Maryland? Why does a great newspaper have to lose ground? He sent me a steady stream of memos on things he felt the Post ought to do. Some were right, some wrong. Almost all were interesting. Ben was tough enough and good enough so that for the most part I not only let him do what he thought was right, I largely agreed with him. When I didn't, his track record was such that I didn't like going head-to-head with him. As time went on, I learned how to deal with him, as he did with me. There were certain things we'd talk about and others I recognized he had no interest in, and I figured out fairly quickly what he had little time or inclination for. Our friendship was forming over those early years. We grew fond of each other and enjoyed a wonderfully complimentary and constructive professional relationship, emotionally uncomplicated. Most important, I saw constant improvement in the Post. The build-up at Newsweek was as dramatic as that at the Post. Because Oz Elliott had a fine feel for cutting-edge issues, Newsweek distinguished itself in the 1960s, becoming a hot magazine by recognizing important trends, writing about racial issues and the new sexual mores, and reporting on them before our competition had awakened to their importance. From a business point of view, the magazine was doing less well. Fritz was extremely lenient with the editorial and business managers, allowing them to operate with relative freedom and without having to adhere to strict budgets. I had no idea of what Newsweek could earn or should earn, and those in charge tended to resent my questions or to interpret any overtures as interference. The company had almost no corporate staff then, except for Fritz and me and a telephone between us. When one started to grow, Newsweek executives mostly disliked the idea and felt threatened. As long as Oz Elliott was editor and Gib McCabe was publisher or president, the magazine went from strength to strength, both in editorial quality and in advertising. However, several changes of editor, including Oz's leaving and then returning, created upheaval and bad feelings. Chaos ensued for a while, with many talented people departing. In press accounts and outside gossip, I often became the fall guy who took the hits for whatever mistakes we were viewed as making, whether in personnel or in editorial decisions. I was also the recipient of grumbling whenever Newsweek editors were unhappy, so I was the target of complaints from both within and without. This disarray added fuel to the rumors that the magazine was to be sold, rumors that inevitably reached print and understandably shook the staff. I suppose they arose partly because financial analysts, especially after we went public, saw no reason why this relatively less profitable part of our business should be retained by a company with responsibility to shareholders. But I believed then, and still believe, that Newsweek matters. When I first went to work, the third part of the company, the broadcast division, consisted mainly of two television stations. There are now six: WTOP in Washington, D.C., a popular and strong franchise, and WJXT in Jacksonville, Florida, which was beginning to make its mark through its investigative reporting. John Hayes had admirably led the operations of the stations, but in 1966, Lyndon Johnson named him ambassador to Switzerland. We tried and failed to find a successor from within the company, so Fritz and I hired Larry Israel, who had been the head of Westinghouse Broadcasting Station Group, and he brought with him a whole new group of people, the most important of whom was Jim Snyder, who became news director of WTOP Radio, then almost immediately of WTOP-TV. Jim was truly a Ben Bradley for television news: charismatic, driving, creative, devoted, tough, and skilled at developing talented people. Larry Israel did certain very productive things. Under him, in 1968, we bought a television station in Miami and renamed it in Phil's honor with the call letters WPLG. And we bought a station in Hartford in 1973. Larry also suggested banning cigarette advertising from our stations before it was mandatory, and thought of the idea of donating our FM radio station to Howard University. Although we didn't comprehend the value of FM, and we all undervalued the gift, this was a unique action. At the time, there was no broadcast station in the United States owned by a black person or group. This was the first, and it later became, under Howard University's management, the number one rated station in Washington. Larry loved broadcasting and held us to extremely high standards in programming and news. The stations were much improved in that respect. But he had little idea of how to run radio, not much sense of business, and even less about how to motivate people. I watched him at several meetings shouting at people and puzzled over this, but decided it seemed to be working. I was wrong. As president of the Washington Post Company, I oversaw all three of these divisions, and in doing so relied on Fritz, who spent most of his time in New York and ran Newsweek, and on different people within each division. Unfortunately, Fritz and I had one failing in common. Neither of us was a manager, and the problems of management seemed endless and intractable. I was always interested in what constituted good management, both within and outside our industry. In the same earnest way that I attacked many things, I began to do my homework in management. I must have driven everyone around me crazy by studying everything so intensely, but I was compelled to know more. I traveled to several cities to observe newspaper operations. I spent a day at Texas Instruments, which had an excellent reputation at that time for its planning processes. I visited the headquarters of Xerox and NCR. I attended a week-long hands-on production process school run by the Publishers Association, the ANPA. I also attended IBM's 7-day course designed for heads of companies to learn more about computers and what they could do. It's hard to realize now how difficult it was for executives only 30 years ago to understand this new technology, then relatively simple, how it could help them, and how to introduce it into a company. For big city newspapers, things were even more difficult because of the stranglehold the typographical union had on us. But I knew it was important and decided to take the course, which was held in an old country house in Endicott, New York. We were a class of 10, and my fellow students included some of the most high-powered, ablest, and brightest executives in the country. All male, of course. There were men who ran large banks in Boston, Chicago, and Charlotte, and two heads of insurance companies, as well as the head of Bamberger's stores in New Jersey, the head of Phillips, Van Heusen Shirt Company, and the head of a large printing company. My unhappiness at finding myself in yet another situation with knowledgeable men far more experienced than I quickly reached panic proportions, but my worry abated somewhat when I began to grasp that they were nearly as apprehensive as I was and were feeling equally sorry for themselves at being stranded there for a solid week. We rapidly bonded together, like people achieving instant familiarity on an ocean liner. My favorite memory of the week was of an evening when we students gathered in one of the tiny rooms that served as bedrooms. Alcohol was prohibited on the program, but several of the men, more daring than I, had packed bottles in their suitcases. All 10 of us stood around the bed, sneaking a drink before dinner. It was wonderfully ludicrous to see these pillars of the establishment standing awkwardly around, drinking clandestinely out of paper cups. By the end of the week, I realized that I had retained enough of what I had learned, at least to joke about it. There was nothing to joke about, however, in my relationship with John Sweeterman. Some of the difficulties arose because I was more interested in the editorial side of the operation than in the business side. Others, however, had their source directly in the way John and I dealt with each other. I resented his inability to accept me. On the other hand, I never understood how much his position on the paper had changed with my arrival on the scene, and I didn't seem able to get over my fear of him. I deferred to him more often than not, backing down quickly whenever there was the slightest hint that there might be a confrontation. I still recall vividly the trouble we had over an admittedly minor matter. The Post's chief telephone operator, Molly Parker, was retiring after 50 years at the switchboard. She had known all my family and was close to my children, who, when they were small, often picked up our direct line to the paper to talk to her. She always took time for them. I gave Molly a farewell dinner at my house and bought her a small diamond pin. When I told John about this, he became quite angry and asked if I didn't see that this set a precedent. From my point of view, Molly Parker's 50 years didn't present much of a precedent problem. I am ashamed to admit that, even after several years in the working world, I was reduced to tears by John's anger, an unacceptable response, and one I eventually outgrew, but not for many years. In some ways, John was a victim of my lifelong tendency to fasten on what is wrong, or could be better, rather than on what is right. I turned this characteristic on myself as well, being overly self-critical much of the time, but I realized that others only became aware of it when they and their work were the target. I was seen as always finding fault or second-guessing. I'm sure it made me difficult to get along with, particularly for someone like John, whom I later came to appreciate and for whom I have great affection. I once asked him what he thought was the most important quality a person running the paper should have. "Good judgment," he replied. "Don't worry about your experience." I was seen as seeking help or advice from too many people on the outside, instead of relying on my own people. That was a justified complaint, but I simply had no idea how differently humans behave in professional situations, and it took me too long to learn, and picking other people's brains was my way of learning. For John, the contrast between working under Phil and working with me was just too great. While I toiled away at learning about management, I was also busy in other areas. We made a few acquisitions in these years, which helped me feel we were moving forward on the business side of the company. The first one, in 1966, proved to be a fine one, if not a great profit center over the years. In a complicated and sometimes irritating series of negotiations, we became the 1/3 owner, with Whitney Communications and the New York Times Company, of the Paris Herald Tribune. The International Herald Tribune, as it became known, is a great newspaper, with an impact around the world far exceeding its relatively small circulation, only about 200,000. But it is read by government leaders and decision-makers everywhere, and above all, it was of great use to our reporters in becoming known abroad and gaining entry. It also helped the Post and the Times become more familiar to readers around the world. Even with the headaches involved, it was a significant, if small, step forward for the Washington Post Company. While work was constantly demanding, my social life was getting to be more varied. My friendship with Pamela Berry added enormously to this period of my life. She often came to political conventions here, and when I stayed with her in England, we would talk about the political situation for hours. The year that Edward Heath became Prime Minister, we together followed the campaign for the leadership of Great Britain, attending Labour Party press conferences and spending an afternoon trailing Heath as he campaigned in his constituency, Bexley, a suburb of London. It was exciting to be there when his Conservative Party won the election, and according to the British custom, he moved into 10 Downing Street within 24 hours as Harold Wilson departed. Ted Heath and I became friends, which later developed into one of those crazy press stories occasioned by a widely read gossip columnist, Susie, who wrote for the New York Daily News. She claimed that I had been seeing Heath every night in London and had extended my stay there in order to continue our candlelit dinners. London's tabloids, and even the venerable Manchester Guardian,